This is part one of our three-part series entitled A Reason to Believe. And I am glad that each one of you are here. I am particularly glad if you consider yourself to be a skeptic in matters of faith. If you're an atheist or an agnostic however you choose to describe yourself, I want you to know that this series is here for you. And as such, I hope that it is something that you learn from and is something that you keep coming back for part two and part three as well. Thank you for being here. It will not surprise you to learn that theists, that is those that believe in God, and atheists, those who believe there is no God, at times have disagreements. But there is one thing, at least one thing, that I am absolutely certain that they both agree upon mightily, and that is this. The answer to the question, is there a God, is the most important answer. Both sides will agree on that. And there's good reason for that, because how you answer this question, the answer that you give, is there a God? If the answer is yes or no, it doesn't matter. It will impact what you do, everything that you do. It will determine things like what job you take or what job you don't take, what you take in school, who you hang out with or don't hang out with, the people that you date, the people that you marry, how you will raise your children. I think it's even safe to say that in one way or another, it will determine how much money you make in your life, what you do with that money, the values that you develop, and further in the world. Everything is impacted by the answer to this question, is there a God? With that weight in mind, I think there's three things we should know before we launch off. Number one, you may have noticed that we are in a church, and consequently, you may assume that I believe in God. If so, you are correct. But I want you to know something, and that is that it is my solid intent to treat the claims for and against God's existence fairly, which means that we must think. We must think. Now, for those of you that are theists, most of you in this room, I think I can safely say, are Christians. We're all okay, but I've heard that at other churches, there are Christians, can you believe this, that will actually go into a church and during a sermon, they will not think. Again, we're all fine. Andrews University campus, we're all doing fine. But at other places, I've heard that this is true. You know, there are some people who are only Christians because of their feelings, not because they have any good reason to be so. And there are people that are atheists. I know, I've talked with them, who the only reason they're atheists is because of how they feel about something, not because they've thought about it. And so what I'm asking for you right out of the gate here is that during this series at least, hopefully other times too, but during this series, you will commit to thinking carefully. Because even today in part one, we're gonna do some heavy slogging here. I need all of your neurons working today. Okay. Number two, I will be available for questions and hopefully some decent answers down here right in the front pew after each one of these presentations. We do this at both services. I will be right there waiting for you. The reason for that is because I may say something that you disagree with and you want to talk to me about that, or maybe I left something out. You know, they say that preaching is the art of what not to say. Okay, so by necessity of time, there's some things I can't touch on. You may want to know about it. Come and see me. Be glad to talk with you about it afterwards. And number three, I would plead with you for an open mind. If you're a skeptic listening right now, if you don't believe there's a God, or you're not certain, or maybe there's certain intellectual opposition that you have to the idea of God, I just plead with you for an open mind as we go through some things here in parts one, two, and three. You know, they say that contempt prior to investigation is the hallmark of the insincere. You are not an insincere person. If you're listening to this right now, it's because you have a reason to be here. And I just want to encourage you, come to this with an open mind. And with those things in mind, let's begin. I want to begin with something that may shock some of you. In fact, I'm going to put it up here on the screen for you. There is currently no proof that God exists. It's a great way to start a presentation on whether or not there's a God, isn't it? There is currently no proof that God exists. And if that troubles some of you, let me quickly modify it here. There is currently no proof that God exists, at least not as some define proof. Now follow me carefully here, because this is going to affect everything else that goes on in this series. Over the years, works from prominent atheists have insisted that there is no proof for the existence of God because of how they perceive the concept of proof. Now, what I'm going to put up next here on the screen is kind of my synopsis of having read widely in this area. So this is not an exact quote, but let me just put it up here. To their way of thinking, proof is an argument so strong that no person whose sense of logic is working properly would have any reason to disbelieve it. Now, that's a pretty high standard, okay? And some have even gone this. They add that, therefore, God, if he exists, ought to be demonstrable empirically. Do you know what that means? Okay, empirically has to do with numbers. All right, if you're going to prove something, this is like the scientific method. This is, you know, through experimentation. In other words, what many skeptics will say, and if you're listening now, maybe you have said this. If God is, you know, Karl Rahner's famous definition of God, that than which nothing greater can be conceived. Well, that sounds impressive, doesn't it? I mean, if it's that big, if it's that great, if God is that great and big, then surely we should be able to quantify him numerically, empirically. We should be able to do a test in a lab. We should apply the scientific method and prove beyond any reasonable doubt that there is a God, to such an extent that no one whose reasonableness logic is working could deny that particular fact. And I will confess to you, if indeed that is the definition that we are going to use, then yes, there is no proof that there is a God. But before the theists in the room revolt, and before the skeptics rejoice at my admission, let me quickly point out that this definition of proof is nonsense. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way, like, oh, that's nonsense. I mean literally non-sense. It doesn't make sense. And let me show you. Let me give you at least three reasons why this definition of proof does not hold up. Number one, the definition cannot live up to its own standards. Listen carefully here. To put it another way, you cannot empirically prove that everything must be proven empirically. Let that sink in. I mean, this gets missed by a lot of people. Let that sink in. Okay. In other words, it falls on its own sword, doesn't it? You cannot empirically prove that everything must be proven empirically in order to be believed. Imagine trying to prove empirically that love exists. Yes, sir. Can I help you? Yeah, I'd like 20 pounds of love, please. Actually, make it 30. I'm feeling generous today, you know? You can't do that. And how about with beauty, you know, nature out there? Yeah, how many ounces of beauty is there in a picture on a sunny, clear day of Mount Rainier in western Washington State? You know? And yet, I think we would all agree, whether you're a skeptic or a believer, doesn't matter, I think we would all agree that the world could use more love now, couldn't it? I mean, what a mess. What a mess we're in. Wars and bombs and people dying and all, you know, poverty, all of these things. We could use more love, right? But you can't go to a laboratory to make it. You can't describe it empirically. And yet it is real. I like the scientific method. Some of the most prominent scientists in the history of the world have been believers in God. These two things are not mutually exclusive. What I'm saying is that empiricism has its limits. And number two, by definition, God is not an object that can be measured like any other object. In other words, there is a category mistake that's being made here. When people say you should be able to empirically prove that there is a God, that's not what we're talking about. When a theist posits the existence of God, we're not talking about an apple tree or a skateboard or a blender or a knife in your kitchen drawer. We're not talking about that. We are talking about a being that transcends these things. And by definition, then, you cannot just overlay the measurements you use for physical objects in the universe and automatically expect it to apply to that which is not physical. We're talking about a categorical difference here. And number three, the definition does not correspond to reality. That is, it cannot be lived. In other words, the things that people believe don't stand up in real life to this definition. Let me give you an example. Let's see. Let me do a little roving here. AU student that is going home for spring break. Am I there? Okay, keep him up. I have a question for you. Yes? Should I not ask you? Is that what you're telling me right now by that head shaking back? Okay, all right. Could I ask you some questions there? Okay, where is home for you?
Canada
is home for you, okay. And you want to go home for spring break?
Yes.
Okay, and you're planning on going home for spring break?
Yes.
Who will you see? Just give me a sample. Who will you see over spring break?
My family, my parents, my sister.
Your parents, your sister. I think I've met your sister. I think when she was here before. Yes, when their family was here, yeah. So you are sure that they're going to be there when you get there, right?
Yes,
okay. Could you prove that to me right now?
No.
You couldn't prove that to me right now.
I mean, they would pick me up at the airport.
They pick you up at the airport. Are you sure about that?
Because they said so.
Oh, they said so. Well, now, if... promises, right? Yeah, I mean, so is it possible that they might not be there at the airport to pick you up?
Yeah.
Okay, is it conceivable that they have sold your room and turned it into a museum? Is it conceivable that that's possible?
I mean, if my sister doesn't live there anymore, yeah.
Okay, if your sister doesn't live there anymore. Okay, so if your sister is gone, then maybe it's a museum that your parents are getting some extra cash from right now. Is that true? Okay. Okay, it's possible, isn't it? So you're not going to go home then for spring break because I've just put some holes in your...
No, I'm still going.
You're still going home.
Yes.
How come?
Because they bought the ticket and I want to see my family.
So let me just translate what she was thinking behind that. She said, because I bought a ticket for it, which is a very practical reason, I must say, right? But I can also tell you, I know why you're going home, and I would do the same thing, because historically speaking, you have some pretty good evidence that makes it reasonable to expect that your parents will be there at the airport, and that there will be a room, and that it's not a museum, and your parents are not getting extra cash. They're waiting for you to get a job and then give them cash back. That's how it works. Okay, right in there, right? So you are doing exactly the right thing. Thank you very much for helping us out here this morning. Yes. And ladies and gentlemen, yes. See, it wasn't that bad, was it? It wasn't that bad. Yes, sir. We do this all the time. You see, here's the truth. Whether you are a believer or a skeptic, all of us live lives of faith. Now, obviously, I'm not talking about faith necessarily in a divine being, but stay with me here. We sit on chairs that we have no empirical proof that it will hold us this time, okay? We will sit in cars and drive in them that we have no empirical proof that it will get us to our destination this time, right? Okay. Have you ever eaten food that you didn't seem prepared? It's going to be hard over potluck, isn't it? You're going to be looking at your food carefully. Yeah. We will date people that we cannot guarantee will honor us and be faithful. And even if things go wrong in a million other relationships, we still will do it because, not because we're idiots, but because we are reasonable. Okay? Because we look carefully at the evidence that is there and we make an informed decision about it. Could we be wrong? Yes, it's true. But when we carefully put the evidence together and we think, remember that word again? We think about it, we can make good decisions. And so what we need to do here is change the question. I would say that logic demands it. Instead of asking the question, what is the irrefutable proof down to, you know, empiricism in the lab proving that God exists? You know, no one could possibly deny. I think instead we need to say this. What is the evidence that God exists? Look at the evidence. Is that evidence compelling? Is it potent? In other words, is it powerful? Is it internally cohesive? Does it accurately describe the world that we live in, the universe that we live in? And most importantly, is it reasonable? Whether we're willing to admit it or not, this is how most people will live, if they're thoughtful people. And with that in mind, Let's take a look at some of that reasonable evidence. Oh, by the way, in the Bible, a book which I understand is pertinent, certainly for theists, did you know that there is this phrase, this message? Isaiah 1:18, God is speaking. He says, come now, let us, what? Let us reason together. God does not ask a skeptic to turn off their brain. Actually, it's exactly the opposite. God says, please, turn on the brain, put your cranium into high gear, and let me show you the evidence. And with that in mind, let's get to it. Genesis 1, verse 1, please. It's on page 1 in the Red Bible. It's probably somewhere or near where you're at. Genesis 1, verse 1. The Bible here, if you're not familiar with it, if this is new to you, this is actually a library. It's got 66 books in it. And Genesis 1, verse 1 is at the very, very beginning. And it has this to say. Let me just read it here. In the, what's the next word? Beginning. In the beginning, God did, he created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And again, if you're a skeptic, that doesn't mean much to you. If you're not a person of faith, this doesn't seem to apply. Let me quickly move on. You'll see why it is that I mention this text. When I hear this text, I immediately think of this place, the Sahara in northern Africa. My guess is most of you did too. And why do I think about that? Well, let me give you a little description here first. The Sahara here, in Arabic, it means the greatest desert. And indeed, it is the largest hot desert in the world. It's the third largest desert in the world after Antarctica and the Arctic, which obviously are not hot, but they are bigger. The Sahara has about 3.6 million square miles. So that's about roughly equivalent to the United States of America. The desert comprises most of North Africa. You see here a satellite image here. You see the Red Sea there on the right. And over off to the west, we have the Atlantic. And to the north, we have the Mediterranean Sea. It is big. There is a lot of sand there. And many people, when they have looked at the Sahara, they do not see evidence for the existence of God here. Or if there is evidence of the existence of God, he's not a very hospitable one. I mean, there's nothing to drink, there's nothing to eat, etc., etc., not even really much shade in most of it. But I would gently suggest that that conclusion is premature. Because actually, there is a piece of evidence staring us in the face in the Sahara which tells us a great deal about the existence of God. And that piece of evidence is this. It's there. Hundreds of millions of grains of sand, they are all there. In other words, there is something rather than nothing. You say, well, why is that? Why is that so important? Well, let follow me now here. Think of it like this. Where did the sand in the Sahara come from? Or is there somebody with a lifetime supply of sand from Home Depot and they're just going out there each weekend and dumping? No. Instead, science today might give an explanation like this. The sand came from wind and or water breaking down rock over long periods of time. Okay, so we would say then, okay, well, where did the rock come from? And so, well, the rock came from magma, from volcanic explosions, and there are many volcanoes in the Sahara, millions of years ago, scientists would say. We say, okay, well, where did the magma come from? We say, well, the magma from that volcano perhaps formed from material collected from thousands of asteroid impacts over millions of years prior to the volcano exploding, etc., etc., etc. Now, many of you may not agree with the scientists' timing, this long period of time, but honestly, at this point, that's irrelevant. What does matter is this. Such a scientific answer would be insisting, and very reasonably, I might add, that nothing in nature causes itself. The sand in the Sahara didn't just appear out of nothing. It came from somewhere, or more specifically, it was caused by something other than itself. Okay? I mean, if you see a puppy, you assume it had a mother, and that mother at one time was a puppy, and that it had a mother, etc., 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 right? And again, you might be thinking, well, so what? You know, so what? That most scientists agree that all things in nature have causes. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal is this. What happens if we follow the trail of causes as far back as it will go? Did you know that most scientists agree that we can follow that trail back to its beginning? What do they call it? Okay, I heard a handful of people say it. That's right. They call it the Big Bang. Now, what I'm going to say next here, I want you to know that I do not personally believe all that I am about to share, but I am going to be sharing this because it is the scientific consensus of current science, particularly in the discipline of cosmology. A little bit of physics thrown in, but particularly cosmology. Let me put a very simple diagram up on the screen here for you. Now, I realize this is probably intuitive. Most of you probably immediately understand what's being shown here, so let me just say just a brief word about it here. The Big Bang is the idea. Well, let's refer to the diagram. On the far left, you see that bright light? That is indicative of the Big Bang. That is before time and matter, etc. That's the Big Bang. The scientists refer to it as a singularity. All of the matter that we see in the universe today was in this infinitely small point, and then explosion is the wrong word. But there was the Big Bang, right? And everything has been expanding since then. Now, on the left there, the Big Bang. On the far right here of the diagram, that is roughly, scientists believe today, about 13.77 billion years of time that's represented on this graph. And on the right, you see WMAP. That is the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe that was sent up in 2001. It lasted, I believe it was 2010 when it finished its work, when NASA turned it off. And it made fundamental measurements of cosmology. In other words, it studied the properties of our universe as a whole. It took a few arc degrees of the horizon. Of course, that's packed, you know, with galaxies, you know, stars, etc. in there. And it did impressive measurements. In fact, by the scientific community, WMAP was considered stunningly successful, helping to produce what is today known as the standard model of cosmology, sometimes referred to as the Lambda CDM model. Now, again, this is generally accepted, has been for 25, 35 years, right in that range. The roots of it go back further, but as far as the standard model for cosmology, this is what is most well accepted in science today. Now, even if you don't understand all of the verbiage of things that are represented here, one thing you do need to understand, when the Big Bang occurred, according to science today, scientific consensus, everything began to expand from relative to one another. Picture a balloon. Okay, a balloon that's not inflated, and it's somehow you could put all the galaxies and stars and whatnot on this balloon on the outside, and then you blow it up. Okay, all of those galaxies will be moving away from one another, not just on this XY axis, but Z as well. Okay, so they're all moving away from one another, and indeed, galaxies are generally redshifted today. In other words, they are giving us, by what we see with light coming back to Earth, that indeed we're all moving away from one another. The universe is expanding. Now, what I'm going to share with you next, I am indebted to various scientists. For instance, Dr. Gerald Schroeder. He's a physicist who received his bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degree from MIT. He served on their faculty in their physics department. He was also a member of the United States Atomic Energy Commission. And he and a number of other scientists have made the following observations. This chart, which by the way is from NASA, you can look this up, it's, you know, in the public domain here. At the Big Bang, you see there on the left, it says quantum fluctuations. Let me just put a red circle around that so you know what I'm talking about here. Quantum fluctuations. This is before the Big Bang. Now, quantum mechanics is a mysterious craft, okay? And it's considered this to be in science today. In fact, there's kind of a viral, well, at least viral in physics circles. Quantum mechanics, this viral video on YouTube going around about a professor who is teaching introduction to quantum mechanics. And basically what he says at the beginning of his introduction, he says, "I don't understand quantum mechanics, and by the end of this course, neither will you." And so there's a bunch of question marks when it comes to quantum mechanics and quantum computing. Maybe you've read about this, whatnot. But one thing is certain. What we do know about quantum mechanics is very useful in describing things at very, very small levels of matter and energy. Okay, and so what scientists, many scientists today, postulate that you actually can get something from nothing if you have the laws of nature already present before the Big Bang. Now, as a layperson, I would question, is that really nothing? Right, but that's for another time. Okay. They postulate that if the laws of nature were already present prior to the Big Bang, you could get something from nothing. And so the question is, well, which laws? Which laws are you referring to? Well, there is an answer. At the very least, you would need to have quantum physics in place and the laws of relativity. Now, I know you all know about laws of relativity. Albert Einstein, you know, it's special theory of relativity, 1905. 1915 is special theory of relativity. General was in 1915, wasn't it? Yes. Einstein, in making these his laws of relativity, putting this together, revolutionized physics and had, you know, impacts on cosmology, etc. Scientists today say at least those two laws of nature should be in place. But notice carefully what happens when we do this. Before the Big Bang, so they say, there were the laws of nature. In other words, there were a set of forces that were already in existence, that started the universe from nothing. The set of forces, by definition, must have had at least four characteristics. Number one, that set of forces is not physical. It's not a part of the physical universe because the physical universe had not been created yet. Okay, it's before the Big Bang. Number two, it acted upon the physical. So this set of forces, it wasn't physical, but it acted upon the physical because in creating the physical, it acted upon it. Number three, it created the physical from nothing. And number four, whatever the set of forces is, it predates the universe because it's before the Big Bang. Not physical, not part of the physical world that we can see, but it acted upon the physical, created the physical from nothing, and predates the existence of the universe. Ladies and gentlemen, that doesn't sound like a set of forces to me. That sounds like God. And just in case you think I'm making this up, let me quickly say I'm not saying that every cosmologist today is a theist and a believer in God, but many of them have become, in the last 25, 35 years, in fact, some very high-profile ones have become believers in God because of the evidence that I just showed you. And many of them, even if they don't become theists, have been strongly affected by... let me give you a quotation here. A guy by the name of J.M. Wersinger, he's professor emeritus of physics at Auburn University, and this is what he had to say. He said, at first, the scientific community was very reluctant to accept the idea of a birth of the universe. Not only did the Big Bang model seem to give in to the Judeo-Christian idea of a beginning of the world, but it also seemed to call for an act of supernatural creation. It took time, observational evidence, and careful verification of predictions made by the Big Bang model to convince the scientific community to accept the idea of a cosmic genesis. The Big Bang is a very successful model that imposed itself on a reluctant scientific community. You know, perhaps one of the most famous stories about this reluctance is Albert Einstein himself. Albert Einstein just had this bias. He did not want there to be a creator of the universe. And when data began to come in that showed that the universe was expanding, obviously the implication is clear. If it's expanding and it seems to be expanding from a common point, then at one point, it was all there together. But the laws of physics we understand, that means that they couldn't have all been there together. All the matter in the universe in this infinitely... There had to have been a time when there was someone doing something about it. He didn't like that possibility. So when he was working with his equations for relativity and special relativity, he modified the constants so that the universe wasn't expanding. He fudged. Some would say he lied. I'm not sure if that qualifies or not, but he did not tell the truth. He intentionally modified his constant so that the universe appeared to be static and stationary. And then a guy by the name of Edwin Hubble began looking into the sky in California. And Hubble, with his today we have the Hubble telescope that's named after him. His measurements were coming back very clearly. The universe is expanding. Einstein goes to see Hubble in California. Afterwards, he has a press conference, and he says, I was wrong. I was wrong. Because Einstein knew the reason he fudged is because people understand there are implications if there's a beginning. I understand the reluctance. I get it. I understand. A guy by the name of Robert Jastrow, who at the time he made the quotation I'm going to put up on the screen here for you, was director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He had this to say about the idea of God being required for the universe to exist. And you need to know that Jastrow, at the time that he said this, claimed to be agnostic. He was not a theist. He was not a Christian. So he's not looking through those types of perhaps biased lenses. Here's what he said, two quotes from him. Number one, astronomers now find they have painted themselves into a corner because they have proven by their own methods that the world began abruptly in an act of creation to which you can trace the seeds of every star, every planet, every living thing in this cosmos and on the earth. And they have found that all this happened as a product of forces they cannot hope to discover. That there are what I or anyone would call supernatural forces at work is now, I think, a scientifically proven fact. And a second quote at a different time from him. He says, "For the scientist who has lived by his faith in reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak, that is, understanding the origin of the universe. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." And he's right. Now, to be fair, atheist apologists like Sam Harris rightly conclude, and let me just quote Harris here. He says, quote, "Even if we accepted that our universe simply had to be created by an intelligent being, this would not suggest that this being is the God of the Bible." And he is correct, but I would humbly suggest that there are other lines of evidence that make us come to that conclusion in a very reasonable fashion. But until then, isn't it compelling? Isn't it reasonable to understand that the Bible's description of God's creative role in the universe is eerily similar to what science has concluded? In fact, notice this, Acts chapter 17, verses 24 and 25 and 28. "The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. For in him we live and move and have our being." As we said at the beginning, in the beginning, God created. But notice this also. It is not just that there is something rather than nothing that points us to the existence of God. It is also that the something we observe seems clearly to have been designed by someone rather than through random chance. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I don't agree with everything of that the people I quote, you know, that they wrote or that they did. But note these words from Ravi Zacharias in his book, The End of Reason, page 35. Ravi Zacharias says this, "Donald Page of Princeton's Institute for Advanced Science has calculated the odds against our universe randomly taking a form suitable for life as one out of," what's that number? 10 billion to the 124th power, a number that exceeds all imagination. Astronomers Fred Hoyle and N.C. Wickramasinghe found that the odds of the random formation of a single enzyme from amino acids anywhere on our planet's surface are 1 in 10 to the 20th power. Furthermore, they observe, quote, "The trouble is that there are about 2,000 enzymes, and the chance of obtaining them all in a random trial is only one part in 10 to the 20th to the 20,000th power, which equals 10 to the 40,000th power, an outrageously small possibility that could not be faced even if the whole universe consisted of organic soup." And then back to Zacharias. "And this is just one step in the formation of life. Nothing has yet been said about DNA and where it came from, or of the transcription of DNA to RNA, which scientists admit cannot even be numerically computed." In other words, the odds of it happening randomly by chance. "Nor has anything been said of mitosis or meiosis. One would have to conclude that the chance of the random ordering of organic molecules is not essentially different from zero." As one of our retired professors pointed out after first service, if you take all of those extraordinarily large numbers, you know, the odds, one in, et cetera, you know, to the nth power, even if you took all of those 13.77 billion years that supposedly has been in the formation of the universe, you would not be able to go through all of the random formations to have that possible ending up with us. There's just not enough time. This brings us to a rather strange but solid conclusion. The odds are so astronomically stacked against life on this earth being the result of mere chance that, notice this, it strains reason far more to believe that we are here by chance than it does to believe the more simple and elegant answer that God created the universe and made this earth for life to flourish on. Many times people talk about theists derisively and say, oh, well, they're just living by faith. Might I suggest that a different brand, but an even stronger one, is required to believe that life is here by chance? There is a reason that the argument for the existence of God from the design qualities we see all over the universe has endured for so long, because the presence of design is a very reasonable indication that there is a designer. If you're walking down the street and a car drives by, you automatically assume, and rightly so, that there was an engineer at some point in the past who designed that car. If you're driving down the street and there's a house on the side of the road, doesn't matter the condition or the age or whatever, you can rightly assume that at some point there was an architect, be they trained professionally or not, that made that particular house. How much more complex is life itself, even at its smallest levels? The presence of design is a very reasonable indication that there is a designer, and thus the presence of a world that seems to be tailor-made to human life is a very strong piece of evidence that indicates there is a God, and not only that there is a God, but that he intended to make beings just like us. The Bible again says this, Isaiah 45 verse 12, "It is I," God is speaking here, "who made the earth and created mankind upon it. My own hand stretched out the heavens. I marshaled their starry hosts." And then in verse 18, "For this is what the Lord says, he who created the heavens, he is God. He who fashioned and made the earth, he founded it. He did not create it to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited." Inhabited by you. The Sahara Surprise is that we find solid evidence for the existence of God in that vast desert. But such evidence is not confined to the Sahara. Instead, as we have seen, it is reasonable to say that evidence for God is all around us. The fact that there is something rather than nothing reminds us that the most reasonable explanation for what we see in the universe and here on our earth is the existence of God. The profound and inspiring presence of the incredibly complex design of the universe and our world can lead reasonable minds to safely conclude that not blind chance, but a creator God made it all. These are powerful lines of evidence that God exists. There are truly good reasons to believe. But there is another reason to believe. And this line of evidence is so strong that it may surprise you to know that most people participate in it every day, but they don't realize it. Every day, I think I can safely say this, nearly every person on the planet is in this stream, in this body of evidence, and it is powerful evidence for the existence of God. And that's what we're going to talk about in part two. And I hope that you'll be able to join us when that time comes. But until then, understand that to be a person of faith does not require you to turn your brain off. On the contrary, God is looking for people that will turn their brains fully to the on position. For there is evidence out there. It is reasonable, eminently reasonable, to believe in God.